This is a service recording of the Unitarian Universalist Society of Oneonta, New York.
Welcome to part three of our special service series for the January session theme of sharing our stories. While our children and youth are exploring the power of stories with special guests, interesting foods, and fun dances and movement exercises, we are spending our time in the sanctuary with some stories of our past, stories of Unitarians and Universalists. Now today I'm going to share two stories of transformation, two Unitarian Universalist heroes that made a difference in the world, the Reverend Olympia Brown, the inspiration for the name of our second building, and in honor of Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Mary White Ovington, often called the mother of the NAACP. Next Sunday, the children and youth and the RE volunteers will be sharing their stories and experiences with us, and after the service, there will be a potluck brunch. Now, for today, I chose two women on purpose because history so often favors stories of men. And in looking back at the last 2 weeks, unfortunately, so did I. So I wanted to have two women today. And one of them is a Universalist, one is a Unitarian. As somebody suggested the first time I asked for suggestions, somebody said, balance. Balance. Okay. Now, over the years, some stories have been told repeatedly, others have been forgotten entirely. There's great power in stories and those responsible for telling them. And when stories aren't told, then not only is our past missing something important, but so too is our vision of future possibilities. These past 2 weeks, I've asked you to share your stories, first your memories of Unitarian Universalism, and then your favorite memories of this community, the Unitarian Universalist Society of Oneonta. Today I'd like to hear something a little bit different, if you're willing to share it briefly. I'd like to hear someone who has inspired you, and why. With the only caveat being, it can't be somebody in this room. I know, makes it more difficult. It also prevents embarrassment. Anybody have someone they'd like to hold up as somebody who has inspired you, and why? Nope. The only caveat, not in this room.
Okay. It's not always easy being different. And so, with the frogs and the pigs and the bears and the things and the everything else, Jim Hansen, for reminding us that no matter how different we are, we can come together.
To go along with today's theme, my mother-in-law inspired me to become a better educated individual and to learn English much better.
I think Muhammad Ali inspired me. They stripped him of his crown, but he came back.
The list is really long, but probably my most fundamental person is my little sister. Her disabilities have made her life difficult, yet she always just kept going and going and going. And things that come easy to the rest of us have never come easy to her. And she just never stopped. And she's successfully working, has relationships and friends, and that's my person that I always look back to.
I'm inspired by Pope Francis. I am continually inspired by my daughter, Sarah, who is not in this room, but whom many of you may know because she was active in this congregation when she was at SUCO. Her continual, restless search for spiritual meaning and to create a meaningful adult life for herself is an unending inspiration.
My high school chorus teacher, John Armstrong, inspired me. He helped me to learn to make sense of music and really get inside it and just brought it to a whole other level for me and is a big reason why I do as much with music as I do.
One or two more.
I was inspired by Jim Wentz, who was the minister when I first came to this church, and it really, really spoke to me, and I've been here ever since.
For me, it's, I think, my biggest inspiration, one of the inspirations of my dad. I've watched him throughout his career. He's an 86-year-old physician who refuses to retire and continues to tilt at windmills throughout his career, and sometimes he wins and sometimes he loses, but it's a continued inspiration for me.
Take two more from out here, and then we'll move on.
I had a friend named Regina, and she was a blind quadriplegic, and she's moved on to greener pastures, but she left me with these words, "Everybody's got problems, but there's no reason to get bitter about it." And that's from a blind quadriplegic.
I'm sorry, I didn't just say something when my husband had the microphone and made you come back, and I'll go quick because we're almost done, but I just couldn't hear all of you share people who had transformed your lives without mentioning the scholar who had the biggest impact on Kevin and I, Olufemi Vaughn, who's now chair of Africana Studies at Bowdoin in Maine. But his influence when I got my PhD in opening up Africa intellectually to us was just amazing and profound and changed our lives in ways that I can't even begin to express. So I just wanted to mention him briefly.
My thanks to everybody for sharing their inspirations. And for those of you who didn't get a chance, that's what the social hour afterwards is for. Find somebody and share somebody who inspired you. Thank you. Olympia Brown was born in 1835 to a family of Universalists with four siblings. The father thought that educating his daughters was immensely important, which was a little bit of a radical idea at the time, so much so that he decided it had to be done by himself. So he built a schoolhouse right there on his farm. He then, along with his daughters, went to all of the neighbors and solicited money to hire a teacher, which they did, and then they started the school right on their property for all of the neighbors so that the girls could be educated. Olympia thought this was fabulous and begged her father to let her continue her studies. So he did. And she went off to study at Mount Holyoke Female Seminary in Massachusetts, which was not a seminary the way we understand it. There were a lot of rules at the seminary for proper behavior. It was not particularly women-friendly. At one point in time, one of her chemistry professors said to the class, and Olympia wrote this in her autobiography, "You are all not expected to remember all of this, just enough to seem intelligent in conversation." There was also a rigid Calvinism at Mount Holyoke, something that Olympia and her Universalism could not abide, and so she left, and she went to Antioch College in Ohio, which was still not as women-friendly as she would have liked. Well, it depends on your point of view. They were very accommodating to women. So the men were required to, in their speech classes, to memorize their speeches, but women were not. They could read because they didn't want to tax them. Olympia thought that that was ridiculous, and so she made a point of memorizing her speeches, and she made a point of making them longer than the ones that the men were memorizing. She earned their respect there, so much so that she was at the top of her class. And her whole family moved to Ohio so the rest of her siblings could go to that college. One of the things she said that was most important to her while she was at Antioch was that she invited Antoinette Brown to lecture and preach there. Now, we often think of Olympia Brown as the first minister ordained by a denomination, but Antoinette Brown had actually been ordained as well, but long before Olympia Brown did. And Olympia convinced her to come and preach. And watching this woman preach, for the first time, seeing a woman preach, was an uplifting experience. Olympia described it as seeing the kingdom of heaven on earth. And that inspired her. She decided that that's what she wanted to do. She got her Bachelor of Arts from Antioch in 1860, and then she decided, time to go to seminary, real seminary. Except there's one problem with that. There were no seminaries for women, because women weren't ministers. So she applied to Meadville, in Meadville, Pennsylvania, and the person there said, I fully support you in what you're trying to do, and I'm a big fan of women and women's rights, but I cannot commit the university to so great an experiment. So no. She applied to Oberlin, and they said, we would be happy to have you come and attend, and happy to have you come and study, as long as you did not participate in anything public. She applied to the Universalist Divinity School at St. Lawrence University. The president there, one Ebenezer Fisher, wrote to her back saying, I do not believe that women are called to the ministry, but I will leave that between you and the great head of the church. He went on to describe how difficult it would be, how hard it would be, how many obstacles there would be, and he left it at that. Olympia got this letter and was ecstatic. She packed her bags, she arrived, and when she arrived, they're like, what are you doing here? He had thought he had written a very discouraging letter to her, and in her own words, his discouragement was my encouragement, and so she arrived. And they couldn't say no because they had said yes. But there were no facilities for women. No bathrooms, no places to sleep, so they had to make accommodations. The professors argued that she would not be able to handle the rigor. Her classmates mocked her for her high-pitched voice and her gender. And she says very little about it in her autobiography, except to say the second year was better. Her classmates came to respect her greatly. She received her Master's of Divinity from St. Lawrence University in 1963. She was the first woman to graduate from a theology school. Not 1863. Thank you. Thank you. 1863. Thank you. Now, she's graduated. Now she needs to get ordained. In the Universalist tradition, ordinations were not by the churches, they were by the councils, which were a collection of ministers and lay people, lay leaders. And they said, no. So she appealed, and they said no, and she appealed again, and she actually traveled to one of the council meetings and made her appeal in person, and her appeal came down to one thing: all I'm asking for is equality. And in a Universalist message, that's a pretty big, important thing. It's central to Universalists. And so they said, sure. But you realize, of course, you're not going to have any churches call you, but we will ordain you. And so they did. Now she has to find a church. It's not going to happen. There were churches out there that were desperate, falling on hard times. There are churches that other ministers decide, don't go there. Mm-mm. Well, Olympia Brown didn't have that same idea, so she got called to serve Weymouth Landing in Massachusetts, a church that had fallen on hard times, but in her opinion, they had very fierce spirits, and she could work with that. So she started working with them, and she was very popular. At that same time, she was asked to do more work fighting for women's suffrage, getting women the right to vote. And somebody asked her if she would go to Kansas to help push for the vote in that state. And she agreed. And her church gave her a 4-month leave of absence to go and do the work. Now, she had been assured that when she got there, everything would be arranged. All she had to do was show up and speak. When she got there, much like when she went to seminary, it was not. She had to arrange for her own lodging, her own publicity, her own travel, her own speaking engagements, and all the while running into fierce opposition. She delivered over 300 speeches in the state of Kansas, trying to get them to vote for the suffrage movement. And while they did not get the majority on that vote, people considered it a vast success because of the amount of publicity and conversations she started. She came back and served her time in Weymouth and then got called to serve the Universalist Church in Bridgeport, Connecticut in 1870. And that church was described as having no breadth of vision and an inclination to close their doors. She went in and completely turned it around, made them very successful. She was very popular there. While she was there, she married John Henry Willis. She kept her professional name. She kept her name, Olympia Brown. That's in 1873. Her husband decided that her ministry was more important than what he did, and so he became the epitome of the minister's spouse. She gives birth to her son in 1874 and a daughter in 1876. And while on maternity leave the first time, a small faction at the church, led by one man, who she describes, and is the only person she describes in her book, as evil, agitated to have her removed, met in secret with various people, invited multiple ministers from around the area who were men to come in and tell the congregation that what they really needed was a good man in the pulpit. She fought very long and hard against this agitation, but it split the church. And the church was in danger of dying again because of her presence there and the opposition. And finally, she left. She resigned her ministry there in 1874. So she started looking for another place to serve. And she heard about the Universalist Church in Racine, Wisconsin. And the person there said, "You do not want to come here. You do not want to bring your family all the way across the country to this church, because the past ministers have left this church adrift, in debt, hopeless, and doubtful that any pastor could rouse us again." So that's perfect. So they moved out there. Of her history of service to churches, Olympia wrote, "I could only find a field in rundown or comatose churches. The pulpits of all the prosperous churches were already occupied by men and were sought by the young men coming out of the seminary into the ministry, with whom I, as the only woman preacher in the denomination, had to compete. All I could do was to take some place that had been abandoned by others and make something of it, and this I was only glad to do." After 9 years, at the age of 53, after turning around that church, by the way, and making it a center point of the community, she left the full-time ministry to become a full-time social activist for women's rights. She still did part-time ministry with many little small Wisconsin churches, what we would call pulpit supplies. This is what we would call now a community minister. They didn't have that word back then. She said of this time, "I never go where I am of no use." Around this time, she meets in person with Susan B. Anthony, and she's inspired by Susan to become a leader of the American Equal Rights Association, fighting both for women's rights and for African-American rights of Negroes. In her 80s, she is terribly disappointed in the women's suffrage movement. She thinks the second generation that took over is too concerned with how they look in public and what society thinks of them. And the third generation that's coming in is more militant. She joins them at 80. She goes to the protests, doesn't care about the weather, doesn't care about the rain. She's out there. Finally, all of her efforts and the other people's efforts pay off and result in women's suffrage. They finally have the right to vote. She's one of the few people of her generation, of the original fighters, who gets to vote in the presidential election at the age of 85 in 1920. That same year, the church in Racine invited her to come back and preach. And it's the last time she preaches at the church. And she says the grandest thing of her life has been the lifting up of the gates and the opening of the doors to the women of America, giving liberty to 27 million women, thus opening to them a new and larger life and a higher ideal. Our opening reading today came from that speech, that preaching. She didn't stop there, by the way. She became an original member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and started working for world peace. Shoot big. She died at the age of 91 in 1926. She's buried in Racine, Wisconsin. The Unitarian Universalist Church there is named for her now. Parson Larson, who you may remember, is their minister. And I've preached at that church. It's a beautiful church. They also managed to convince the local city to name the elementary school after her. It's a long story. They came up with a bunch of names. Olympia Brown was nominated. They narrowed the list down to three names. Olympia Brown was not listed. And the church women decided that that was a travesty. So they swung into action, made lots of calls. And all of a sudden, there was a fourth choice added to the list. And Olympia Brown won. And of course, our building is named after her too. Let's talk about Mary White Ovington quickly. She was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1865. Her family were members of the Second Unitarian Church in Brooklyn. She remembers as a child walking down the street and seeing one of her Presbyterian classmates cross the street to avoid walking down the street with the Unitarian. She felt very snubbed, but at the same time gratified that they recognized the strength and depth of her convictions. She was inspired by her minister, the Reverend John White Chaddock, who was a radical. And so she went off and attended Packer Collegiate Institute and Radcliffe College, where she starts studying sociology. She sees in person and hears speak the slave, the escaped slave, Frederick Douglass, and says to him, "I'm not sure which is worse, being a part of the oppressed class of people or being one of the oppressors." She feels inspired by that, so she starts studying employment and housing issues in Manhattan, especially among the African-American population, the Negroes. There she meets W.E.B. Du Bois, who she had greatly admired, and they, together, well, she meets with him the founders of the Niagara Movement. The Niagara Movement's named after Niagara Falls. They wanted to be a forceful flow of social change, much like the water flowing over Niagara Falls. She joins them. She starts writing for radical journals and newspapers. She writes a book entitled Half a Man, The Status of the Negro in New York, which is a rather radical book at the time. And in it, she says, if we deny the full expression to a race, if we restrict its education, stifle its intellectual and aesthetic impulses, we make it impossible to fairly gauge their ability. I would say that's still true today. At one point, she decides to start work with the Tuskegee Apartments in San Juan Hill neighborhood in Manhattan, completely African American. She moves there. Everybody throws a fit. This is no place for a white woman to be living. She goes anyway. She settles in, and she says, just because no one else sees fit to do anything about it is no reason why I will not. The building owners, the settlement owner, is not in support of the reform she's trying to make, of the help she's trying to provide. And so she starts spending her own money, her own life savings on her work. After 8 months, she runs out of money, and she has to leave. But the people there remember the work she's done. In 1908, The country is shocked to hear about a huge race riot in Springfield, Indiana. 40 homes are destroyed, 24 businesses are sacked, 7 people are left dead, all of them African Americans or African American owned businesses and homes. A call goes out for people to help and aid the black citizens. Mary hears the call. She gets together with Du Bois, and they start the National Negro Committee in 1909 to start talking about how they might help. And the very next year, they start the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. She's chosen as their executive secretary. She works for women's suffrage, world peace, she's an avowed pacifist, and for civil rights. She gives speeches to 14 different campuses that year to try and show students that there were whites who also hated the oppression. This was not just a black organization. She served the NAACP as staff or board members or in various capacities for 38 years. As time passed, Du Bois became a bit more radical and separatist and started ruffling a lot of feathers. She spent a lot of time smoothing things over and eventually works to keep the NAACP as a cooperative force for integration, not separate. She retires in 1947. She dies in 1951. Her memorial service is held at the Unitarian Community Church of New York City, where her ashes now reside. The NAACP honors her with the official title, Mother of the New Emancipation. Now, both Olympia and Mary are what we might consider a traditional story from Unitarian Universalist heroes. They had faith at an early age. They were committed to getting an education. They would not be dissuaded or held back from their goals. They gave themselves wholly to their cause. They paid a heavy price for their contributions. And they succeeded in effecting change. And then they were recognized for their amazing effect on society, though in some cases not until after their death. In our faith tradition, we hold up agents of transformation. We venerate rebels. Our heroes are social misfits. We admire those who persevere and those who will not quit. If these are the stories we tell and the names that we honor, what does that say about us? What does it say about who we are and what we should be doing today? Who are our new Unitarian Universalist heroes going to be?
Thank you for listening to this service recording of the Unitarian Universalist Society of Oneonta, New York. We are a welcoming congregation, accepting and affirming the lives of gay, lesbian, and bisexual people here among us. All members of the human family are welcome here. Our worship services take place every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. in our sanctuary, located at 12 Ford Avenue in Oneonta, New York. For more information about Unitarian Universalism and our congregation, please visit us in person or explore our website at www.uuso.org. This service is shared under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives, 4.0 International License.